James C. Bennett is a writer and entrepreneur. He was co-founder of two private space transportation companies and other technology venues. He has written extensively on technology, culture, and society. He is best known for his writing on the concept of the Anglosphere, the emerging global community of English-speaking peoples. He is the author of The Anglosphere Challenge, The Third Anglosphere Century. A former columnist for United Press International, has contributed to the New Criterion, National Review, The National Interest, The New Atlantis, National Post in Canada, and The Daily Telegraph in London. Michael J. Lotus writes as Lexington Green for the Chicago Boys blog, that's Boys with a Z, on history, politics, and books. He is the editor and lead contributor to the Clausewitz Roundtable, 2012 winner of the Explorers Foundation Cobden Bright Award for his contribution to the Anglosphere. He has a BA in economics from the University of Chicago and a JD from Indiana University, Bloomington. He practices law in Chicago, and these two gentlemen are next to discuss their book, America 3.0. Stand by to reboot. This is the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. James C. Bennett and Michael J. Lotus, it's a pleasure to welcome you onto the bridge of the mothership and Coast to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm good. Well, thanks, John.
Well, we can start this thing off just anywhere you like. Maybe what we should do is, let's take it from this point. There seems to be unity increasing in some segments of our society, but there seems to be a sort of a canopy of division over our civilization, the American civilization. You know, a lot of name-calling and, you know, there's this attempt, there's always been an attempt to label people in groups. Much easier to label groups than individuals, obviously. But how do we reboot this thing with so much division, aided and abetted, in my opinion, by primarily mainstream media?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening here, and this is Mike talking, John, is this. The country is in a period of transition, and the current kind of crisis we're in is not the demise of America, but a transition to something new. And during transitional periods, we've had a major one in the transition from the agricultural America to industrial America. We had a somewhat smaller one in the 1930s. People become very polarized. There's a lot at stake. Politics, as usual, is breaking down, and very major changes in the country have to happen. And when that happens, people see that what they've come to know and what they've been used to are going to change. And some people cling to what they know, and other people maybe are confused about what the future is going to bring, and some people see opportunities they want to seize, and it raises the heat on the politics.
I would also add, this is Jim here.
Hey, Jim.
The country has never been homogenous. The country was settled by people from different parts of the British Isles and elsewhere that had very different customs, religions, and attitudes. We've kept up these differences as regional differences and differences in subgroups and such. And the Founding Fathers started with the idea that we had this heterogeneity. You could call it the design of the Constitution around that concept. We are coming out of a very unusual period in American history, World War II, the New Deal era, where we had a very unusually high degree of homogeneity, and it seemed like harmony. And that was, to some extent, a historical accident, but it was way off the norm. Actually, we're going sort of more back to the way America has always been. And I would also say we're going back to the premises under which the founders wrote the Constitution.
You know, there's an interesting, it's all quite interesting, but let me just an excerpt from your books. It's written here, many freedom-loving Americans oppose what they see as traditional values regarding sexual morality. They have a visceral dislike for religion and its rules, and they find or imagine church-going people to be boring and bigoted, and they recoil from people who use the word family when they talk about political issues. If many Americans cling to their God and their guns, libertarians only like the guns part. But our free institutions have grown up on this family foundation. In other words, American libertarians fail to understand the historical foundations of the liberty they prize so highly. Can you just amplify that?
Sure. One of the things that's perhaps the most novel thing we bring with the book is an understanding of the historical roots of the American type of family. And there's social science on this that's not well known. And the American type of family is what's called the absolute nuclear family. And the absolute nuclear family is unusual in the world, where people pick their own spouses. Their parents don't pick their spouses for them. The parents aren't expected to give a particular inheritance to anyone, and parents can't demand the same kind of care from their children that they can in other cultures. We don't have large extended families where we rely on our cousins and uncles to take care of us and have that kind of mutual connection. And as a result, America has been, the English-speaking world in general, and America in the most extreme case, has been a uniquely liberty-loving, individualistic, inegalitarian type of society. So the kind of ideal society that our libertarian friends, and I pretty much am a small L libertarian, would like to see is really a image of the kind of American family life and the culture that grew up on it here. And it's not typical to the rest of the world.
You know, you mentioned in here that at first we were, back in the 80s, we were worried about Japan, and then, you know, China began rising, and they appear to be the next great superpower. A lot of people feel like they will supplant us as the world's superpower. I'm thinking it's just, it'll be business as usual. I believe in this thing called economy rotation. Japan had theirs, now China's going to have theirs. And between the U.S. and the European, primarily the financial, specifically the banking institutions, this is all part of their plan. Does any of that fit into your work here, America 3.0?
Generally speaking, I would say we agree with you about what's happening with China, with a couple of kind of additional points on that. For one thing, China has been playing the catch-up game. I mean, they came from a very, very low base when they finally gave up on Maoism. And when you're imitating the leader and you have a society that's, you know, basically industrious and hardworking, that has a lot of people getting educated, and they're able to come up with a plan and stick to it, you can make up a lot of lost ground quickly. It's because you're already following a pattern that's well known. And that's what the Chinese were doing. Everyone knew and knows how to make a steel wheel. You can go and copy successful ones. Everyone knows how to make an electronics factory now, because you can go and copy the existing ones, and that's what they did. They used their labor advantage to catch up very fast, and although we can't actually trust the growth rates that they're reporting, it's pretty obvious that they've had high growth rates for 30 years, very high growth rates. At some point, they will start to catch up, and at that point, they find that it's much harder to be close to the leader of the pack than it is to follow a well-known path. And their society is very well set up as a follower or catch-up economy. Once they caught up, they will find out what the Europeans and the Japanese both found out as they started to close the gap with America, that it's very hard to pull into the lead. They also have a bunch of big problems, which we can get into that at some point if you want to give us the time on that. But they have a bunch of big problems brewing, and there's one that I think they're just beginning to be aware of, which is the manufacturing revolution going to distributed manufacturing, which is going to wipe out the wage advantage of the low-wage economies. And this is going to strike over the next 10 to 20 years, probably. So I think China is going to, it's gotten into the rank of the big powers. It's going to stay there. They're too smart, and they built up enough wealth and enough market penetration worldwide that they're never going to fall back to the kind of situation they had in the 1950s, say. But they're not going to eclipse the United States, and we have a number of reasons why we believe that's so.
All right, you know, one of the biggest criticisms of our society, I like to call it our civilization, is the destruction of the nuclear family. So what is the American nuclear family? And is it being destroyed? And are there big consequences for this?
The American nuclear family is, as I mentioned, is a kind of unique phenomenon in the world. And destroy may not be the right verb. There's no doubt that something really massive has occurred in the last several generations. We had the birth control pill come in 1960 or so. we had already had the liberation of women by labor-saving machinery and devices in the home, and we've had the sexual revolution that really got it going in the 60s and 70s. We've had an explosion of divorce, of abortion, of single parents, and the consequences of this are still playing out. I would say they're mostly negative and destructive, mostly harmful to people, though some people no doubt feel liberated by the consequences of all this. But family structure that underlies us and the cultural expectations, the way we think about things, the way we think about the world, the way we think about each other, these things take centuries to form. And even though this transformation of society, the sexual revolution, was a huge change, I don't think that the fundamental structure of society and the fundamental expectations that people have are going to be destroyed. And also, you know, periods when there's a sexual license and social disorder tend not to go on for generation after generation. There's usually a period of correction. People get tired of it. People get sick of the world they've inherited from their parents and grandparents and the mess they made and try to clean it up. And we don't talk too much about that in the book because to talk about the future of politics and economics is hard enough. To talk about a moral transformation of society, I think, is beyond the ambit of what we're trying to do in this book. But it has happened before in the past. It happened in England in the 17th and early 1800s. Happened in the United States when the Irish came over here, and there was a real growth of religious faith that lifted these people out of poverty and helped move them forward. And we had the Great Awakenings in the USA that were religious outbreaks that changed society. So, you know, stand by for something good to happen. But, you know, there's no doubt that something, I think, primarily destructive and very disturbing has happened. But I don't think the American family has been destroyed.
I think the heterogeneity of America, what we've been talking about, is one of the saving graces here, in that these breakdown of patterns are much more pronounced in some parts of the country than in others. And we've actually seen this kind of big gap grow up between the coasts and the interior part of the country on a lot of the social indexes that you see. What we're talking about is we expect this heterogeneity, I hate to use the word diversity because it's been kind of hijacked to mean a very particular set of programs, but genuine diversity, which means people actually believing different things and constructing their communities around somewhat different concepts of what is the good way to live. It's always been a feature of America, and we believe we're going to see more genuine decentralism, more genuine diversity. This is going to create space for a lot of different ways of constructing family to merge. I think quite a few of them are going to go back to some version of the classic American absolute nuclear family, and that we think because of the beneficial effects of this family type, of the way it breeds individualism and self-reliance, these communities will be the successful ones going forward. So there will be a sort of a competition among many different approaches to family construction, and I think that the classic American pattern is very strong, has a lot of strength and robustness, and will prevail in the long term. But I think that you will also see some of the modern patterns will continue to persist in some areas for quite a long time.
And as I forget who said it, but, you know, the future belongs to those who show up.
Exactly.
And the communities that have more traditional values, that are more traditional in their religious practices, have bigger families. And demographic attrition will, on its own, have in my view, positive effect on the future of the country as well.
Demographic attrition.
Yeah,
sure. By that I mean that the folks who have larger families and raise their kids to have certain values will come to just be more numerous than people who choose to be childless or have one or two kids and be below replacement. So that over time, in a generation or two, you're going to have a cultural shift in the country toward a more traditional set of values and a more traditional attitude towards family life. That's basically what we're perceiving is going to happen.
Well, you know, for a long time, for example, now we'll go out onto some ice that may be a wee little bit thin, but it's like we know that certain demographics, certain cultures, certain races tend to produce larger families than others. Now, this is just an observation, but it seems to me like, you know, for the longest time we heard that, Caucasian married couples or unmarried, whatever, let's assume they're married, it's all legal. Let's just make that assumption. That'll be our baseline. They have their replacements. They have two children. You know, I don't know where they get 2.7 children or any of that. I guess that's just a statistical, one of those lies that Twain referred to. But, and then you find other groups, Hispanic families, for example, they typically have more than two children. Or at least this is the common understanding. So when you talk about a cultural shift, are we talking about a cultural shift along racial lines, or are we talking about a cultural shift along some sort of an economically designated demographic? In other words, the ones, doesn't seem to me like money is making a great deal of difference. You find a lot of people who are making plenty of money, maybe even both parents are working, but they cut it off at two children, maybe three. But that, for most of the people that I've talked to over the last several years, three kids, that's kind of pushing it. Two, we're good. Now, do you find that to be something that may change the entire demographic fabric of the country?
I think it'll be more along cultural lines, and I don't mean ethnic lines per se, but often religion or just lifestyle, degrees of conservatism. One thing that's interesting is the fertility collapse that we've seen in the developed world is starting to take place worldwide in a lot of places that people have always thought of as being high fertility areas. I think Mexico is down to replacement or just below. Brazil, I think, is at or below replacement. Iran, and very interestingly, is, I think, at replacement and below. The Iranians have their last cohort of excess young males in the army right now, and in 20 years they won't have that, which is a little, a bit frightening, because it means that their leadership is in a use it or lose it situation, but that's a whole other topic. What we're seeing typically also with, say, Hispanics in America is that the fertility rate is also linked to how long the family's been in the country, how many generations, and the education levels. Because as they are in the country for more than one or two generations, and as the education level rises, the fertility rate starts to converge with white Americans.
You know, it's interesting. Vladimir Putin called for a national day of lovemaking or something, because the new babies coming into the world in Russia are at an unacceptable level. They're low. New births are low. I've also heard the same thing about Germany. Outrageously large percentage of the men who were interviewed in Germany said that the proper number of children is zero.
Hmm. Yeah, so, about 20% of the young population has or intends to have zero kids, and about another 20% is one kid. So the fertility gap may not be between two and three kids versus five and six, but between, zero and one or two.
Right. And there's a, Jonathan Last wrote a book called "The What to Expect When No One's Expecting." I've only had a chance to glance at the book, but he had an article, and in it he said that Americans are surveyed that the average they say they'd like to have if they felt economically secure is about 2.5. And that seems pretty convincing. This characteristics of the European style of family that make it more likely that under a situation where kids are going to survive infancy and they have a welfare state that's going to provide for people in their old age, that they're likely to have fewer than two. So I think the USA, is despite declining births in the USA, by comparison to the rest of the world, I think we're in pretty good shape. Further, it was Charles Murray had a book recently, and he talks about how the well-to-do in America don't preach what they practice, that in fact they're pretty family-centric and are shading above two kids and moving up towards, as you pointed out precisely, anecdotally, people say two is okay, three is kind of pushing it, but it's above replacement. So I think our long-term prospects are pretty good, that we're not going to have a demographic drought like the Russians. The Russians, it's a catastrophe. and Western Europe is declining.
All right, let's stop for just a moment, gentlemen, and we'll come right back after our bottom of the hour break. You're listening to James C. Bennett and Michael J. Lotus. Their book is America 3.0 on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. Well, thank you very much. On the coasttocoastam.com website, which you should visit with regularity, Unexplained Mysteries of 2013 from Discovery News, the crazy, ingenious plan to bring hippopotamus ranching to America. Well, watch out, because those things will get you, and I'm not kidding you either. American wins $1 million Picasso in a raffle, and that time, dentists and candy companies teamed up for evil experiments. Hope you had a good week. Hope you're not too stressed out about the upcoming holiday season. You know, Christmas is next Wednesday. And I hope you really will rest ye merry, meaning restful and contented. You can weaponize a pizza roll. You can weaponize a pressure cooker. But do not weaponize Christmas. Be pleasant. Even if you're not Christian, just take the day off and find a way to be decent and caring about everybody, and keeping in mind that some people will exploit your attitude to their own ends. So remain alert without remaining suspicious. And we'll be right back with our guests tonight. It's an interesting discussion. Let's talk about freedom and the love of freedom for its own sake, being far less of a universal value than many Americans realize. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. James Bennett and Michael Lotus, there's so much in this book. It's we really need 12 hours. You know what I mean? And then people would need to get your book to go back and review, because it's really excellent. And we're going to have a history lesson here in a minute. I'm going to ask you to amplify some of the things that you wrote regarding the demise of the Austro-Hungarian Empire being a useful analogy. But going back to the thing that I mentioned at the break, at the end of the break, a love of freedom for its own sake, I'm taking from the book, is far less of a universal value than many Americans realize, and far less than many Americans currently wish it was. Other people simply don't care about it as much as we do, and no amount of preaching or even coercion is likely to change that. This commitment to personal freedom is rooted in our type of family life and our historical experience built on that family life, as we will show below. And then President George W. Bush, in his second inaugural address, stated that all peoples of the world love freedom and aspire to it. But this is true only in a very narrow sense, and is not true in the way he seems to have meant it. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Jim, why don't you take that one?
Yeah. Well, what I would say, I think the key was when we said... when Bush, President Bush said, all people love freedom, it's true in a very narrow sense, in that people have their idea of what is good, and they don't like constraints that prevent them from pursuing what is good. But for a lot of people in a lot of different cultures, this means the good of your extended family, your clan, your tribe, or whatever. And what you dislike is constraints on the ability of your clan to improve its position relative to others. In other cases, if freedom means your particular religious ideas and your ability to make those predominant. The idea of the individual as the center of society is, sociologically and anthropologically speaking, quite rare. Many languages in the world don't classify kinship in the relationship of an individual person to the other people around. You define yourself by your relation to your family or clan and your position in that, and all the other relatives that you deal with are defined by their relationship to the clan rather than their relationship to you. Some languages, for instance, don't discriminate between your father and your father's brother. You use the same word, which essentially means your grandfather's sons. So you just see yourself as this unit. In some languages, for instance, you have these names, which are basically just number names, where you're the third son of the second grandson or whatever, or the other way around. But the idea of an ego, what they call an ego-centered nomenclature, where you are the center of your mental universe and everyone else is defined by the relationship to you, is fairly peculiar to English-speaking society and a few others in the world. This is partly what we talk about when we talk about the absolute nuclear family, which is an anthropological term. This has real-world implications because in the absolute nuclear family, America, the other English-speaking countries, and a very few other European countries have this. There are no obligations, there are no hard legal binding obligations to the rest of the world once you become an adult. And on the other hand, the rest of the world doesn't have much of an obligation to you. You are what you make yourself in the world. You don't feel obligated to remain in your hometown as a matter of family loyalty, or even in some places, the law stands behind this. You've always believed that you have the right to go out and pick your own mate without the permission of your parents after you're an adult. These are fairly rare things in the world, and the kind of family we produce has been historically a novelty. And other countries look at this and they say, oh, you people are very cold. You have no, you know, warm family relations. Actually, in a lot of these other cultures, you have a huge amount of resentment because often the individual is obligated to obey somebody else even after they're an adult. The senior member of the family, the clan, or the situation in the so-called authoritarian family, where women who come into family live with their husband's parents and are under the control of their mother-in-law until she dies. So that's, I think, the majority of domestic murders in these societies consist of daughters-in-law trying to hasten the demise of their mothers-in-law. Which right. is, you know, a fairly small percentage of the murders in our society. So what we're saying is what we think is normal is actually quite rare in the world. And our social institutions are built around this. Historically, it's been very interesting because after, say, the 1840s, you started to get a lot of immigrants coming to America from very different cultures with very different expectations. There's a lot of immigrant literature. I mean, The Godfather is a great piece of immigrant literature about the clash between the old country values and American values. And what the immigrants kept finding is they could preach their old country systems to their kids all they wanted, but they couldn't enforce them legally. And you had this situation over and over and over again. They would come to America, they would be much richer than they were in the old country. Everyone was really happy until their kids grew up to adulthood. And all of a sudden, oh my God, our daughter is going out and dating this person from a different ethnic group than us, or from a different church. And we absolutely forbid her to marry him, but he's going to do it anyway. So they go down to the policeman and they say, our daughter is going to marry against our will. You know, stop her. And the policeman says, how old is she? Oh, she's over 21. Well, there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. That's her right. And they're apoplectic because they didn't realize this about America when they came. And this is how the immigrants have historically been assimilated. It's basically marriage by marriage. And they all these other things where the kids didn't stay under the authority of their parents after they got to the age of majority. Now you have immigrants from cultures where the culturally dictated thing to do when a daughter disobeys like this is to kill her. And so you have these so-called honor killings, which are actually called clashes between different family systems. And, no, amazingly enough, there have been cases where the defense lawyers argued that, well, you know, the father couldn't help it because this was his cultural conditioning to do it, and courts have actually bought that crap some places. But
the USA, not yet.
I don't
well,
think
they're getting
I
mean, close.
The defense lawyers have tried it. I don't think it's worked. But it worked.
And John, to follow up on that, I mean, the reference to George Bush, I think, is important because He talked about having humility in foreign policy, and then we ended up engaging in nation building to great cost to the USA.
Yes.
And we need to be really careful about that kind of thing and not to project onto the rest of the world that they're going to have the same desires as we're going to have and want to organize themselves in the same way, or that if they try to, that they're going to be particularly good at it. And we have enough difficulties here at home. We have enough challenges here at home without undertaking projects of that type that, you know, so far haven't been very successful, at least in recent generations.
What do you think is the motivation to do this? All these endless regional conflicts. I mean, Vietnam, to me, was... I still can't really figure out why we were there, and I don't understand why we're in the Middle East still 10 years later after the second invasion of Iraq. I don't get it.
There's a bunch of things going on. Vietnam, I think, was largely the Cold War conflict and the notion that we had to confront communism at every step. And then you had a very serious bureaucratic failures within the military at coming up with a way to engage in a conflict they weren't familiar with. And they had a draft, too. And if you have a draft, the troops are, you know, a free good, and free goods get used up. And thanks be to God, we got rid of the draft soon thereafter. I think that the Iraq and Afghanistan efforts were undertaken with a goodwill, but they weren't thought through. And you don't have to take any project on an ad hoc, kind of ill-conceived basis, and it takes on a life of its own instead of having a clear end point that you can aim at. And that's it, just rotten planning and poor thought went into both of these efforts to the great cost of thousands of people in our society and theirs.
But a lot of it comes from the fact that we underestimated, our planners and our political class underestimated the depth of the cultural difference between us and these other countries, and therefore they thought it would be a matter of going in and within a few years you would begin to have democracy emerge and you would have these modern institutions and relationships emerge. And it took us many centuries to evolve these mechanisms. It took other countries, many centuries and many false starts before they got to this point. I mean, we think of France as being quite a bit like us and quite a modern nation, but, the last military coup they had was basically in 1958. And if you look at the last 200 years, they had many gaps in their democratic experience. Spain's democratic experience, dates from, 1978, I think. Greece is something like that. If you ask who's had consistent functioning democracy with no interruptions over the last 100 years, it's pretty much the English-speaking world, Switzerland, and some parts of Scandinavia, and that's really about it.
All right. Some of these things that you've written in here are, well, a lot of them. All right, most of them are really worth developing for our audience, because we see the financial system is seems to be holding on by bloody fingernails. All this quantitative easing and now, you know, the Bitcoin thing, the threat of an untraceable, or at least that's the theory, untraceable exchanges between persons and so forth. At the same time, you have clearly there are problems in our government. And in fact, Vladimir Putin said, hey, you know, one thing I'll give Obama, and that is he's able to do what he does. And he's still there. He just keeps going. So you got Vlad Putin popping off in this way. Simultaneously, we have the militarization of our police and this huge Department of Homeland Security ammunition buildup. And I understand that, you know, government entities buy in bulk and so forth. But it spooks the people when they think that, why do these guys need billions and billions of rounds of ammo? I mean, are they gonna use it on us or what? So in looking at some of the historical references that you've made in your book, America 3.0, it's almost as though, well, are we about to do this thing that Europe went through in the middle of the 20th century again? Are we going to go through this? Because it looks like all of the pieces are right there, ready to put together into a puzzle that makes a really ghastly picture once you've assembled it. And I've made reference to this many times, that the Germans, for example, art, literature, music, technology, everything, you know, highly evolved civilization, and they descended into the Nazi era, and half of their country was destroyed. This coming on the heels of just a couple of decades a couple of decades of when they lost all that property at the Treaty of Versailles following the close of World War One. So people are wondering, have we not looked far enough into our past to see that we are about to repeat it?
John, there's an awful lot in that question. I think this is kind of the deep history and then the kind of current circumstances. And the current circumstances, I agree with you, it's very scary, and it's not quite clear to me why it is we're seeing the militarization of the police and large-scale purchases of ammunition by the federal government for its agencies. I simply don't know what they think they're doing. The surveillance state that we have, and the NSA surveilling our behavior and our records and our communications, is particularly troubling. And one of the things we say in the book is this: you can't uninvent that technology. The only solution to that is for people to become politically mobilized and compel it to become transparent and really have punitive laws on any abuse of that power. And I think we're only just starting to try to push back on this. There are certain legitimate concerns, but counterterrorism and enforcing the war on drugs have become an excuse for turning the country into a surveillance state where the government basically has a default position of keeping its eye on everybody electronically. I don't think that's what we want to have. It's not what the Constitution contemplates. Fourth Amendment says you should be secure in your papers. Well, the equivalent is your electronic communications today. And, you know, they're searching, looking at all this stuff without a warrant. So this is a very serious problem, and we need to push back against it, and we need to mobilize ourselves politically for many things for the period we're in now, and that's one of them. Now, on the deep kind of structure, are we looking at a 1930s-like Nazi takeover-like scenario? There's reason for hope there. One of the features of this absolute nuclear family is, and the culture that's grown up on it, is the Americans and the English-speaking people have been very resistant to any totalitarian type of government. Daniel Hannan, you may know of, he's an Englishman who's a member of the European Parliament, and Hannan's a very, very eloquent defender of freedom and very eloquent spokesman for the values of the Anglosphere, the English-speaking world. And he points out that there's only been something like half a dozen communists ever elected to an English-speaking parliament, none to the American Congress. We've never had a fascist or Nazi-type party that was anything more than the scale of a nuisance. So the English-speaking people, the American people, do not tend to like this sort of thing or fall for it or find it particularly appealing. We find that use the government as a way to get things done and to gain things we want and to accomplish large projects, but turning it into a kind of religious-like, cult-like thing like the Nazis did or the communists did, where we're not generally, that's generally not what we've done historically. I agree the strange kind of cult of personality around the edges of some of Mr. Obama's supporters are odd. But on the other hand, lots of people sort of laugh it off. So, you know, we need to be vigilant, and we need to become more politically mobilized to secure ourselves against some of the intrusions we're facing. But I don't think the American public is going to be supporting a kind of dictatorial crackdown. And for them to pull it off, if someone in the government wanted to pull that off, they'd need a massive support. It couldn't be done as a sort of coup against 312 million Americans by a small minority or by some executive fiat. So, you know, there's a lot of things to worry about in our current circumstances, and that's not one of the ones that keeps me up at night.
There's this saying I like, which is that the jackboot of fascism is always poised over America, but somehow when it actually comes down, it always seems to land on Europe. So there's something to that.
And I think you're right.
I will say this militarization of police stuff is really... it is really bothersome, almost in kind of an aesthetic way as an American. I happened to be in Brazil like 15 years ago or something, and I was at a nice cafe on the beach of Copacabana, and this like platoon of guys in military uniforms and gear jogged by. I don't know what they were doing there, but they were jogging down the beach, and they had, you know, camos and webbing with grenades hanging from it, and big assault rifles, and all the gear. They looked like they're about to rappel out of helicopters into a jungle landing zone and fight. And I thought, who the hell are these guys? And I saw the shoulder flashes and was like the Ministry of Agriculture Special Police or something. What a banana republic kind of thing when the Ministry of Agriculture has this commando team jogging around the city.
I tell you what, can you hold up right there and we'll finish up with that story when we come back, because the computer will chop us off in furtherance of news. James C. Bennett and Michael J. Lotus are our guests tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by for more.